This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Oh, look! Markets go down, too. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Thursday, the 10th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. I'm going to mention this right up at the top to A, get it out of the way, and B, in so doing, hopefully reinforce its normalness. All three major stock indices fell today, and not a little bit either. Tad more than 2% on the NASDAQ, and here's the deal. That's what's supposed to happen. Stocks go up. Stocks go down and we move on. You can't stay at all-time highs forever, y'all. All right, speaking of moving on, let's, shall we? There is real estate news on this Thursday. Two of this country's biggest institutional landlords are joining forces. Starwood Waypoints Homes and Blackstone's Invitation Homes are merging. They'll have 82,000 homes for rent in metropolitan areas across the country, a deal which is kind of in and of itself a housing market indicator, as Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports.
When corporate landlords first started buying up single-family rental homes after the financial crisis, people thought it was a radically risky idea. 10 years later, it has paid off. David Korak is with FBR Capital Markets.
Fundamentally, the single-family rental market has really taken off in an institutional form for the first time in history.
When institutional investors first got into the market, the homes were cheap to gobble up, and rental profit was easy. But now,
at this point, prices have gone up a lot on the home purchase side. Rents have gone up some, but less rapidly than home prices.
Lori Goodman is with the Urban Institute.
So what these guys are trying to do is figure out how to keep returns up, although lower than they once were.
So these companies are having to consolidate where they can make the most money. Doug Harder is with Credit Suisse.
Both of these companies have targeted cities where they see job growth as being better than average and building of new homes as being below average.
Demand for homes high, supply low, you get faster rent growth. By consolidating, the companies can also save money on things like maintenance. Lawrence Yoon is with the National Association of Realtors, and he sees a problem with all this.
What the investors are gobbling up, this is coming at the expense of potential first-time buyers.
On the other hand, institutional investors only own a small percentage of homes in any given market. And Lori Goodman with the Urban Institute says typical landlords can be really hit or miss. Corporate landlords are more consistent.
I am not worried about the impact to consumers. I mean, I think what these guys do is provide professional management.
Whatever the long-term implications, this merger is a sign that corporate landlords for single-family homes are here, and they're here to stay. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Remember that big announcement from the White House in the past week or so that the Taiwanese tech manufacturer Foxconn was going to build its first U.S. factory, a $10 billion plant in Wisconsin? It was going to be 13,000 jobs in exchange for $3 billion in tax breaks. Yeah, well, hang on. Legislative analysts in Wisconsin are saying the state is not going to break even on that investment for more than 25 years. That's the best case scenario, by the way. These mega incentive offers, tax breaks in exchange for jobs, have been on the rise since the recession. Marketplace's Amy Scott looked into whether they really pay off for local economies.
Over the years, state and local governments have handed out tens of billions of dollars in tax breaks to attract or keep employers. And mega deals, those worth more than $50 million, are on the rise. That's according to the nonprofit group Good Jobs First, which has counted about 400 such deals since the late 70s. Greg Leroy is executive director.
The average price per job in that database is $658,000 per job. From a taxpayer point of view, there's no way taxpayers can ever break even.
Tax incentives can still be worthwhile, says Timothy Bartik, senior economist with the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research.
Economic development should not be viewed as a way for state and local governments to make money. It should be viewed as an investment to try to improve the number and quality of jobs and thereby provide benefits to the state's residents.
Bartik says the benefits are greatest when the incentives bring high-paying jobs to states with high unemployment. That's not the case in Wisconsin, where unemployment is a low 3.1%. Governments can protect their investment by adding provisions to recover money if companies don't deliver. Wisconsin Senate Majority Leader Republican Scott Fitzgerald would like to see benchmarks built into the deal.
I think what we're looking for is, okay, tell us kind of when these jobs are going to be in place and how quickly we're going to reap the benefits.
One winner, if the Foxconn deal is approved, could be Illinois, just over the border, where workers and local businesses could reap some of the benefits without the cost to taxpayers. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Uber, amidst its many troubles, is going to be winding down part of its business. The Wall Street Journal reports the company is going to end its car leasing program this year. A program that started back in 2015 as a way to get new drivers. The idea being, if you wanted to drive for them but maybe didn't qualify for your own car loan, Uber would hook you up. Turns out a lot of those borrowers were what are known as subprime. Never a good prefix in the money lending business. Marketplace's Ryan Kailath has more on that.
If you're wondering why people seem nervous about the subprime auto market, it might have something to do with ads like this one.
Everyone is approved at Byers Auto Sales, regardless of your credit.
Even if we have two repossessions, a foreclosure, and a bankruptcy,
everyone is approved.
So why do lenders offer loans like this?
If you're lending to subprime and below borrowers, you can charge them higher interest rates. So there's more money to be made, but you do take on more risk because they have a higher chance of defaulting.
Lacey Plocky is chief economist at the auto website Edmunds.com. She says auto lending tightened up during the recession, then loosened a few years later, and lenders saw the opportunity there. But she adds that in the last year,
lenders are starting to tighten up lending again. So we're seeing a rise in the average credit score for new and used vehicle loans.
Alec Gutierrez of Kelley Blue Book says the comparisons to the 2008 crisis are overblown. For one, he says less than 20% of auto loans are subprime. Second, carrying a car loan is not like carrying a mortgage.
Having a car in your household is an absolute necessity, and people tend to prioritize making that payment over making payments for their home. So your average consumer is going to do whatever it takes to keep that car loan current and keep that car in their driveway so they can get to work.
Compared to the housing market in 2008, Gutierrez says, the scope and scale of the auto market pales in comparison. In New York, I'm Ryan Kailath for Marketplace.
We should also tell you, Uber-wise, that Axios reported today Uber founder and former CEO Travis Kalanick is being sued for fraud by Benchmark Capital, one of his early investors. The key allegation is that Kalanick packed the company's board of directors with people who basically would let him do what he wants. We should say here that even though he's not the CEO anymore, Kalanick is still on Uber's board. Wall Street, we touched on already. Details, numbers, when we get there. There was a hearing in federal court in Detroit today in a suit brought on behalf of a group of that city's school children against the state of Michigan on this issue. What is the right to literacy in this country? And what's the economy got to do with it anyway? Lizzie O'Leary, the host of our weekend program, has been covering this case. Hey, Lizzie.
Hi, Kai.
So talk to me, would you, about the Detroit schools here for a minute?
Yeah, the Detroit schools are really complicated, and I'm going to explain also why this is a federal case or a case in federal court. So basically, for 15 years, Detroit schools have been in and out of state control. So these plaintiffs are suing the state, and the plaintiffs are suing the state in federal court because, frankly, they are looking to set precedent here. So we've been to Detroit public schools. There are a lot of issues from, you know, ceiling tiles that fall down, no air conditioning when it's hot, lots of teacher vacancies. And one of the things that public counsel, the pro bono firm that is representing the students, says, and this is their main argument, is that all of these things add up to inadequate access to literacy, basically that the state schools aren't providing that. But a really important thing here is in the state's argument, and they would not comment, to be clear, but in their brief, they say, look, we're not to blame because there are bigger issues here, notably poverty. Part of their defense is it is too hard to educate children coming from this background.
You obviously went out to Detroit. You talked to some students, some kids out there. What was it like?
The kids had a bunch of different experiences in the public school system, some of them in charter schools. But there were really some common threads, those physical condition things that I mentioned, but tons of substitute teachers, many of whom they say weren't qualified to teach. I want to play you some tape from a kid we met called Hussanatu Diallo. She graduated from Universal Academy Charter School, and she told us a little bit about her experience there.
My junior year, we had a lot of substitutes after most of my teachers were fired. We had teachers who didn't really understand the subject, so we weren't learning anything throughout the whole school year. We had substitutes who would sleep in the middle of class. There was no learning at all.
She is actually going to Michigan State, but she also said, you know, she just didn't feel prepared getting ready for life at school after high school.
I have to do the classes that I did before just because I didn't understand. Like, I don't fully understand compared to the other students.
All right, so here comes the connected dots part of the interview. Make the connection here between literacy and the lack thereof and Detroit's economy, would you?
Part of it is the state's defense that poverty is to blame here. But the other part of it is the plaintiff's assertion that you really can't participate in the economy and the revitalization that's happening in Detroit if you can't read. So I'm going to play you some tape from Sandy Barua. He is the president and CEO of the Detroit Regional Chamber, you know, all those businesses. And this is what he had to say.
Detroit's recovery or any urban recovery is not going to be nearly complete until opportunity is spread much more equally. We really don't have a luxury as a society to kind of leave people behind.
You know, we hear about this revitalization in downtown Detroit, but that's a very small part of the city. So to kind of make that a wider thing, that means the education, in his view, really needs to be stepped up because that's lagging behind. The city's watching this lawsuit. But, you know, this has implications all across the country, Kai.
Lizzie O'Leary is the host of Marketplace Weekend. More of the weekend teams reporting on Detroit on the show this coming weekend, right, Lizzie?
Yep.
All right. Talk to you soon. Thanks.
Thanks, Kai.
The NFL preseason has started, 7 games on the schedule tonight, and there is some news about the folks on the field in stripes. The league has announced it's going to make a handful of its officials full-time employees this year versus the part-timers that NFL refs have been for approximately forever. That on the theory that doing so is going to lead to higher quality games, a better product, in other words. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains.
The NFL is the last of the 4 major American sports leagues to use part-time officials. There are about 120 officials on the payroll right now. They're all part-timers, and they make between $75,000 and $200,000 during the 17-week season, depending on how long they've been reffing games. Most hold other jobs throughout the year, like Ed Hockley. When he's not throwing flags for unsportsmanlike conduct, he's a lawyer. Refs resisted full-time employment until the money made sense, says John O'Rand with the Sports Business Journal.
The referees didn't want to do it because they didn't want to give up these side jobs. Some of these side jobs are lucrative, and they thought that the NFL's offer wasn't going to pay them enough to give those up.
The NFL brings in more revenue than any other American league, $14 billion last year. But game attendance and television viewership has recently declined. One theory behind that is games have become sloppy. Some blame the refs. Oran says this is the NFL trying to answer that criticism.
When calls went wrong, that was always something that was very easy to point to. Well, they're using, you know, high school teachers, or they're using lawyers as their referees, not full-time trained referees.
Referees work one game a week. Those last about 3 hours. So what's a ref do with the other 37? Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith College.
They'll train, they'll teach, they'll be involved in some planning, and they'll be full week employees.
The NFL plans to hire up to 24 full-time referees beginning this year. Any from the pool of the more than 120 officials are invited to apply. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
We were really trying to save the home.
Deportation and its economic after effects. But first, let's do the numbers. I personally would have gone with the wah-wah trombones, but that's just me. Dow Industrial's down 204 today, almost 1%, 21,844. NASDAQ down 135, 2.1%, 62.16. S&P 500 declined 35 points, 1.4%, 24.38. Let me say this again. Stocks are supposed to go down. We talked about the deal between Blackstone and Starwood, the nation's largest real estate rental home company, by the way. Invitation rose 3.9% on the news. Waypoint from Starwood climbed 5.1%. Wells Fargo is planning a board shakeup in the wake of a succession of financial scandals. The Wall Street Journal reports that one. Wells Fargo off 1.5% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.2%. On the nose, you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One hears a lot that in its politics, Hollywood tends toward the liberal. The Kansas-based Koch brothers, whose company you may know is an on-again, off-again underwriter of this program, in their politics, they tend toward the conservative. And one would imagine that that twain would never meet. Except movies are expensive to make, so producers need money, and movies can be profitable, and people with money like profit, which is where the Koch brothers come in. Their participation in a company providing what's called slate financing, a company once run by now Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin, was revealed by Tatiana Siegel in The Hollywood Reporter this week. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Steven Mnuchin, we know about his Hollywood experiences. How do the Koch brothers figure into all this?
Well, secretly, of course, but back in 2013, Steven Mnuchin was putting together some investors for the Rat Pack Dune slate financing facility for Warner Brothers movies. And he brought in a few secret billionaires. And at the time I was covering it and I didn't know who they were. And I sort of always kept it in the back of my memory. And then I sort of recently found out and confirmed with three sources that it was the Koch brothers as well as Bill Gates.
Tell me what slate financing is, would you?
Basically, every studio except for Disney has them. It's partners that come in and they co-finance across the entire board of films of a studio. So Warner Brothers, let's say they put out a certain amount of films every year, they will have this partner, in this case, Rat Pack Dune, that puts up 50% of the studio film's budget.
Just overall. So they're not financing specifically, shall we say, Wonder Woman, but just the whole slate.
Pretty much. Okay. Warner Brothers keeps back a few of its sort of best bets, like they keep back the Harry Potter movies. But for the most part, it's all of the movies.
This story is an interesting confluence of money, entertainment, politics. None of those are strangers to Hollywood, though. I wonder what the reaction has been as this story has come out. What have you heard?
Well, I would say that the people I've talked to, there was a collective like, oh, my God, this is horrifying to hear. It shouldn't come as a surprise, though, to anybody. There's no shortage of really rich people who come in and invest in various ways in Hollywood. But what's different here is usually people who do that, it's because they want to get a good seat at the Oscars and really make a show about it because they know they're not going to make a ton of money out of it. But in this case, they're not doing it for show. They just are sort of like, okay, let's put some money here and see what happens.
One of the things you point out in this piece is that investors typically get into Hollywood, and then once they discover how tough the movie business can be, unless you get a mega blockbuster, they get out pretty quickly, too. And it looks like the Kochs and other folks in with Steven Mnuchin have hung around for 4 or 5 years now.
Yeah, it's 4 years now, and they haven't lost money, but they haven't made a terrible amount of money either, because it's pretty much at even, but yeah, usually you do see a quick exit like, oh, you know, that was fun being in Hollywood, but it's time to go make real money somewhere.
Yeah. Let me get back to your earlier point about the reaction from many in Hollywood about this news that you broke. I wonder if they're going to stop taking the money, right?
Well, they can't. There is a deal in place that goes through a certain amount of time. Now, whether Warner Brothers re-ups that deal when it expires, I believe in 2019, you know, obviously they'll have that option. And who knows, the Koch brothers might be out by then.
Right.
Mnuchin's already out. So, well, right. He's put the money into his stake into a blind trust.
Right. Because he had to for his disclosure. Do you have a sense that there are others in this besides Koch and Bill Gates?
I do, but I don't know who else they are. And because they're not required to make that information public, I don't know yet.
Tatiana Siegel, senior film writer at The Hollywood Reporter, writing on the Koch brothers in Hollywood. Tatiana, thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
So far, Immigration and Customs Enforcement under President Trump is arresting and moving to deport about 13,000 undocumented immigrants a month on average. That's a couple thousand more than during the last months of the Obama administration. When those people are taken out of this economy under presidents of either party, there are ripple effects. Marketplace's Rima Kreis explains what housing and deportation have to do with one another.
Maria's best and, frankly, only customers are girls who are super eager to turn 15. Here in Huntington Park, a largely Latino neighborhood in Los Angeles, she runs an event planning business for quinceañeras, the traditional Latin American coming-of-age party. But today, there are no teens with their moms here picking out the perfect dress. Maria says since the election, sales have plummeted by 60%.
This year, a lot of people don't want to throw parties because they're afraid. They think that immigration will show up, so they just don't want to.
Maria, who's lived in the U.S. for 28 years, is undocumented, which is why we're only using her first name. She says the political climate isn't just affecting her small business. Lately, she's been worried about what would happen to her home if she's ever detained. That's why earlier this year, she transferred the title of her house to her 22-year-old daughter, who's a U.S. citizen.
I refinanced it and took the money because if they come and deport us, we have that money put away.
More than 20 years ago, Maria and her husband scraped together $2,000 to pay for the down payment. The thought of losing her home, she says, is terrifying.
Because everything we made, all that we built, could fall apart at any moment.
Maria is among the 30% of undocumented immigrants in the U.S. who own a home, according to the Migration Policy Institute. Most of them are able to take out loans by using their taxpayer ID number. Jacob Brew, a sociologist at Brigham Young University, says a little notice consequence of deportations is families losing those homes.
It's as though someone was, you know, divorced or someone lost their job. Many of these other triggers for home foreclosure that are well known, deportation is operates like that.
Rue found that during the Great Recession, deportations led to higher rates of foreclosure in Latino communities. In counties that let local law enforcement detain undocumented immigrants, foreclosure rates among Latinos were almost 70% higher than in other places. That's because most undocumented immigrants who are deported are Latino men with jobs.
And so when you remove that source of income from the family, then that has an impact on the overall household.
Marissa Calderon heads up the National Association of Hispanic Real Estate Professionals. She says many undocumented immigrants hold their wealth in a home. So if they lose it, they could lose money for college, medical bills.
It has this sort of domino effect on the rest of the community and on the economy, frankly.
Calderon says a huge spike in deportations could have some impact on the housing market.
People don't come to this country dreaming to be renters. They want to be able to have a little place to call their own.
That's what Claudia wanted. Her parents brought her to Wichita, Kansas from Mexico when she was 12 years old. That's where she fell in love with her boyfriend, got married, and bought her first home.
I wanted it to have something more stable for my son. Like, you know, a lot of my friends, they still have their memories or like their pictures. And I didn't have that.
Claudia was on her way to building that until in 2005, her husband, who's also undocumented, was detained. He lost his painting business. The court fees and bills started piling up.
We were really trying to save the home.
But they couldn't make the mortgage payments. They lost their home. And eventually her husband was deported. He's back now seeking political asylum. But instead of the two-bedroom home with the big backyard, they're renting in the same Wichita apartment complex they were in when they first got married.
It was really hard for me last year when I turned 40. It was like, I cannot believe I've been working really hard my whole life and had dreams, and here I am at 40 starting all over again.
Claudia says she wonders where they'd be if they hadn't lost their home. I'm Rima Kreis for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, President Trump had what you might call a free-flowing press conference this afternoon, touched on a lot of things, a whole lot of things, including being asked whether he was disturbed by the recent decision by Vladimir Putin to order the United States to cut its embassy staff in Moscow by 755 people. Here's what he said.
No, I want to thank him because we're trying to cut down on payroll. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm very thankful that he let go of a large number of people because now we have a smaller payroll. There's no real reason for them to go back. So I greatly appreciate the fact that they've been able to cut our payroll for the United States. We'll save a lot of money.
Okay, just a thought here. That might not be the most efficient way to cut personnel costs. Also, full disclosure, I used to be a Foreign Service officer. With the admonition that we were at record highs a week ago, the Dow off 204 today, almost 1%. NASDAQ down 135, that is 2.1%. The S&P 500 declined 35 points, 1.4%. We will, as always, see what tomorrow brings. John Buckley, Deirdre Depke, Eve Epstein, Danielle Irby, Suzanne Levy, Betsy Streisand, and Eve Troe are the Marketplace editing staff. Our interim managing editor is John Gordon, running out of time, so I can't give him a hard time. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.